Okay, well, today we'll go ahead and finish up with chapter 21. I thought what I'd do to start with, I wanted to just kind of walk through. I think it's good to review the things we've covered kind of at a high level, just to keep in the context of the flow of the book of Genesis. So what I wanted to do was just kind of walk through verses 12 through 21 sort of quickly before we finish out chapter 21. But again, chapter 12 through 21 covers the first 25 years of Abraham's stay in the land of Canaan, his sojourn in the land of Canaan. And in chapter 12, so I'll go back, you know, chapter 12 is really a foundational chapter where Abram, at the age of 75, he leaves Haran and goes down to the promised land, you know, obedient to the call of God. He goes to the land of Canaan, and he receives the promise of the land, seed, and blessing. So we really have the establishment of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis chapter 12. And again, you know, goes from Haran to Mesopotamia down to Shechem. And we think, oh yeah, nice little journey. It's 450 miles, so walking, you know. So it's a 5 to 8 week journey, kind of plugging ourselves into the geography, I think makes the context even more meaningful and understandable for us. And it's accompanied by his wife Sarai and by his nephew Lot. And of course, Lot plays a role in the future of things. And chapter 12 starts out great and ends on a little bit on a debacle in Egypt. Remember, there's famine, so Abram at the time leaves the promised land, leaves Canaan, and goes down to Egypt because of the famine. And he endangers, which is okay. He's never criticized for going to Egypt for the famine. But what he is criticized for is when he gets there, in order to protect himself from a perceived danger, he offers up his wife, Sarah, says that she's his sister. So she goes into Pharaoh's harem. And again, this was a self-protection thing. So we see that. So he endangers his wife for his own protection, again, claiming she's his sister. Of course, we see the same thing then when we get to chapter 20 with Abimelech. So we know that Abram is a man of great faith, but he's also far from perfect. Okay, and that's a key attribute of all of God's saints is, you know, do the right thing, you know, people of faith, but far from perfect. So then after chapter 12 and chapter 13, we have the battle of the kings. The four kings from the east come down to the Jordan Valley, and they attack and take over the five kings of the Jordan Valley. So kind of the four kings from the east versus the five kings of the Jordan Valley. And the Jordan Valley is we're talking chapter 14 here. Sorry, let me back up. Chapter 13, we'll do that first. Chapter 13 is the separation of Lot and Abram. There's a conflict over grazing, and they need to separate. And Abram says, Lot, you take where you want to go, and then I'll take whatever's left over. And Lot looks down and sees the lush Jordan Valley and says, I'll go there. So the only problem is that's where a lot of wickedness, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and those cities were all there. And so Lot goes down that way and, you know, foolishly chooses that area. And then Abram stays in the land of Canaan, okay, kind of the area that he's to inherit. And closes with an emphasis, chapter 13 closes with an emphasis on the eternality of God's covenant with Abraham, and then a reaffirmation of the land and seed promises. So this land and seed promises kind of go through a lot of these chapters in this section of Genesis. So then chapter 14, we get to the battle of the kings. Okay, so Lot's living in Sodom down in the Jordan Valley. These four kings from the east come and battle these five kings from cities in the Jordan Valley. And they're defeated. And so the kings from the east carry Lot and everybody else up way north. And Abram actually puts together a force and chases them and catches them and defeats them and brings his nephew Lot back. So, and then in chapter 14, another key event there is it closes with the account of Melchizedek. Okay, the priest, king priest of Salem, which was likely Jerusalem at that time. And Melchizedek comes on the scene. That's the first we hear of Melchizedek, and that's the last we hear of Melchizedek, kind of this mysterious guy that just comes on the scene suddenly and then leaves just as fast. We never hear from him again in the Old Testament history. But Abram meets Melchizedek on his way back from conquering those four kings up north, brings back his nephew Lot and the other captives. But he meets Melchizedek on this return, and then Melchizedek gives him a blessing, pronounces a blessing on Abram and on the God of Abram. And Melchizedek, we talked about this quite a bit, especially going up to turning over to the New Testament, to Hebrews chapter 7 in particular. Melchizedek was, of course, a shadow or typified the greater reality to be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Okay, and we have the combination of that office of priest and king, and it demonstrates the superiority of Jesus' priesthood over the Levitical priesthood. Okay, in the New Testament, one of the big problems people had with Jesus was, well, he can't be a priest, he's not a Levite. So, but there's an order of priesthood outside of the Levitical priesthood and the order of Melchizedek. Jesus was a priest in the order of Melchizedek. So then Abraham, during this section, Abram acknowledged Melchizedek's position as a priest of the true God and as Abram's spiritual superior by giving him a tithe. He gave him a tenth of what he had. He accepts the blessings from Melchizedek and tithes to him. So again, this thing with Melchizedek, and we don't see Melchizedek again. So until we get to the New Testament in Hebrews. Okay, so Genesis chapter 12, that initial receiving of the land, seed, and blessing promise. Chapter 13, the separation of Abram and Lot. Chapter 14, the battle of the kings and the appearance of Melchizedek. Then in chapter 15, God promises Abram a biological heir. So Abram and Sarah are advancing in age, and there's a problem. They've been promised an heir, but there's no heir in sight. And so they're skeptical about what's going to happen. But God promises Abram a biological heir in chapter 15. And then chapter 15, verse 6, again, another one of those really key verses. Then he, Abram, believed Yahweh. He believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. So again, first time that it's clearly taught that salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone. And again, this verse is quoted at least three times in the New Testament, Romans 4, Galatians 3, and James 2. Again, talking about the reality of the nature of salvation. Again, it's by grace through faith. It's an undeserved act of God's unmerited favor. We don't deserve salvation in any way. We don't contribute to it in any way. And I like one guy said that I was reading, and I've quoted this before because I really like it. It says, my only contribution to my salvation, my only contribution is the sin that makes salvation necessary. So we contribute one thing, and that's sin. We also have in chapter 15, and that closes with the covenant formalized in a ratification ritual, confirming God's promise of land and the descendants. So it's guaranteed, again, the covenant is guaranteed by God alone. It's unconditional. And we'll look at that cutting a covenant ritual. We talked about that quite a bit back in chapter 15. We'll see that again in chapter 21. And then also in chapter 15, we see the first prophecy of Israel's future slavery and eventual return to the land. They're enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. God tells Abram in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13. So again, more of God's plan being revealed here. Then in chapter 16, we had Sarai and Hagar. So Sarah devises this, again, there's no baby coming, no heir. So Sarah devises this ill-conceived human solution to her inability to conceive, and she gives Abram her Egyptian slave Hagar as a wife to bear a child. So then 86-year-old Abram, he's 86 at this point, so he was 75 back in chapter 12. So we've had 11 years pass, right? 75 to 86 is 11. Is that right, Tom? Yeah, okay, thanks. So a number of years have passed, and so again, Abram fathers Ishmael, and then Sarai becomes contemptible in Hagar's sight because Hagar's now the mother of her husband's child. And so Sarah then treats Hagar in an ill manner. So you can see, can you see, imagine the family dynamics going on here? I mean, it's a mess. So Hagar takes off, flees into the wilderness, where she encounters in verse 7 the angel of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord. First time we see the angel of the Lord. Again, a pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus Christ. So, and then the angel of the Lord, angel of Yahweh, instructs Hagar, go back to Abram's household, and promises Hagar that she will be blessed and he will multiply her seed through her son Ishmael. So then chapter 17 jumps forward. So that happens. Things are going on. And when we get to chapter 17, we jump forward 13 years. So a lot of time passes between chapter 16 and chapter 17. And then chapter 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21 all occur within 1 year. So we have quite a bit of stuff. It was a busy year that year. So chapter 17, again, Abram is 99 years old. So that would be 13 years after chapter 16. And here we have the giving of circumcision as a sign of the covenant. And it included all the males 8 days old and older. And we have a reaffirmation of the eternality of the Abrahamic covenant and its land and seed promises. And then we're told that the promise of seed, the promised heir, is going to be fulfilled through a son to be named Isaac, who will come from Sarah. Okay, you're not going to adopt anybody into your family to fulfill this promise. You're not going to have somebody besides with your wife Sarah to fulfill this promise. It's going to be fulfilled with you and Sarah having a son together, and you're going to name him Isaac. And then in chapter 17 is where Abram's name is changed to Abraham, and Sarai's name is changed to Sarah. And again, kind of pointing to the significance and certainty of the fulfillment of God's promises. And also, I think, a demonstration of God's power. You know, the one who gives a name is the one who has power. And God here renames Sarai and Abram. Okay, then verse 18, we had the three mysterious visitors to Abram. We know they were reading through the chapter. It turns out to be Yahweh and two angels. We get a little bit of a covenant timetable in chapter 18. Sarah's going to bear the covenant son within a year. That's revealed to us. So we know the son is coming now soon. And then we have the chapter closes with that discussion between Abraham and Yahweh regarding the justice of God and the destiny of wicked Sodom. Remember the questions that Abraham now was asking Yahweh. Well, will you destroy the city if there's 50 righteous? How about 45? How about 40? How about 30? How about 20? You know, if you remember our kids doing that kind of thing. So that's kind of the picture that's unfolded there. God graciously uses these questions, seemingly silly questions of Abraham, to show that he treats the righteous and the wicked differently, is really the point, the nature of God's justice. Then in verse 19, there weren't 10 righteous people in Sodom, and Sodom is destroyed in chapter 19. God destroys Sodom and the other wicked cities in the valley, we're told. These would be the same cities that Abraham rescued when the kings from the east had come in earlier in the book. So he delivers Lot and his family. They flee the destruction that's raining down on Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities. But then we also saw the influence of a wicked environment, even on God's people. We're told in the New Testament that Lot was righteous. He was saved. But we see this influence, the influence that this wicked environment has had on Lot's family. First we see, remember, lingering Lot. Lot didn't really want to flee. He was like, you know, too much there. But he's convinced, and he does eventually leave. But on their way out, what does his wife do? She looks back. She looks back with longing for the life she's leaving. I mean, their house is gone. Their friends are gone. Their business is gone. Everything's gone. And she looks back, and she's changed immediately into a pillar of salt. And of course, there's debate, but was she encased in some kind of molten, you know, all the stuff's raining down? Was she encased in something? Or was her chemical structure actually changed into salt? And we don't know. It doesn't matter. What matters is that she was inoperative. She was essentially dead at that point. And then, even worse, the chapter closes with Lot's two daughters. Remember, they're worried about carrying on the family line. And from their perspective, maybe everybody's dead. Everybody they knew was dead. And so they make their dad drunk and then have relations with him and are impregnated by him. And their children, the Moab, are the future, are the predecessors of the Moabites and the Ammonites. So we see these two people groups who are enemies, you know, cause strife with Israel in the future, are a result of this union between Lot and his daughters. Then verse 20, we have Abram meeting Abimelech. He travels. He's been staying kind of in the area of Hebron and in that general area. He goes over to the area of Gerar, and he meets King Abimelech there. And again, you know, chapter 20, we're what, 25 years or whatever, after chapter 12, he does the same thing. He is worried about his life, so he says that Sarai, his wife, is his sister. And his wife, goes into the king's harem, but God mercifully intervenes, Yahweh appears to Abimelech the king, and says, stop. This is his wife. You're a dead man if you touch her. If you kind of remember the conversation there. And so, again, God mercifully protects the king Abimelech, the king of Gerar, from having relations with Sarah. And then I like the way that Abimelech approaches Abraham and confronts him. You know, we have the priest of God, or the prophet of God, being confronted by a pagan king and saying, why did you do this? You know, and Abraham said, well, I was afraid. And the king is like, well, here's your wife, here's some goods, you know, go. Was kind of the picture here. So again, he confronts and chastises Abraham, King Abimelech does. He restores Sarah to her place as his wife. And that kind of sets the stage for what we're going to look at today at the closing verses of chapter 21. But then chapter 21 starts out again with the long anticipated, you know, the waited event of the birth of Isaac. And this is what we looked at last week. The covenant heir and line of promise. And this is a joyous event. And we saw those play on words. You know, Isaac is born and Sarah's laughing and all those things that are happening. There's just this joyous atmosphere. Yeah, down in verse 6. So Abram's now 100 years old. So again, we're 25 years past Genesis chapter 12, where we're told that he's 75 years old. So, and Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Everyone who hears me will laugh with me. And the name Isaac comes from the word to laugh. So there's wordplay going on here that we'd pick up if we were reading it in Hebrew, but we don't pick it up in English. But it really is emphatic on this joy that's occurring here. But then down in verse 8, the child's weaned. That would have been a year or two later after the birth. And verse 9, Sarah, again, Isaac's mother, saw the son of Hagar, Ishmael, the Egyptian whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing in jest. So there's this big party, you know, the boys weaned, and this big party at that time. We talked about that a little bit last week. And Sarah is watching, and Ishmael is sort of ridiculing the toddler. And Sarah doesn't like that. So then there's, again, this falling out between Sarah and Hagar. And Sarah demands that Hagar get out. And Abraham sends Hagar and Ishmael away into the wilderness. And then we see again the appearance. It's interesting to me how the angel of Yahweh speaks to Hagar again, just like he did previously. But God promises to protect Hagar and her son. So again, God at work here even through the sin of men, protecting Hagar and Ishmael, Abraham's son. So now we'll go ahead and let's go back into chapter 21. And I think, too, just at the, again, those right before we get to verse 22, which is where we'll start today, you know, we see this, again, this expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael from Abraham's household, and then God's reassurance to Abraham. Because remember, Abraham is distraught when Hagar sent away, but God reassures Abraham, and then he reassures distraught Hagar. Remember, Hagar had left her child under a bush thinking he's going to die, like from dehydration. Their provisions were all used up. And so it's a very, very sad scene. But then the Lord appears again, or talks again to Hagar, assuring her that Ishmael would indeed live and that he would be blessed. And I like verse 20. And God was with the boy, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness, and he was an archer. And he lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So Ishmael turns out to be okay, and we'll pick back up with Ishmael in chapter 25. Okay, so we'll go ahead and pick up today with verse 22. That was a long introduction, wasn't it? Okay, verse 22. Now, what happened at that time, so these events have occurred, the birth of Isaac, the celebration, the expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael. Now, what happened at that time, that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. So now swear to me here by God that you swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my offspring or with my posterity, but according to the loving kindness that I have shown you, you will show me and the land in which you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I swear it. So does Abimelech have a reason to suspect that Abraham's not a man of his word? Yes, because he told him earlier that his wife was a sister, almost got him killed because of that. So kind of this suspecting Abimelech brings his top military commander down to meet with Abraham. And Abraham, he knows that Abraham is a man of God because God told him in a dream that he was a prophet. And so he's coming to Abraham and he's saying, hey, we need to figure something out here. And number one, I need to make sure that you're not going to lie to me again. You almost got me killed once. So what's going to happen now in the future? And one thing, too, with Abimelech and Phicol, and he brings his military commander. He's got his army general there. Like, are we going to have problems or what's going to happen here? Just kind of the seriousness of the situation. You know, in the event, what he was going to want is a peace treaty, a non-aggression pact. And if that fails, then, you know, what are we going to do? And he wants to have his military guy there with him. Just kind of a note on, we talked about Abimelech likely being a title or like Pharaoh's kind of a title. And it's likely that Phicol may be that as well, a title. And we're going to run into Abimelech and Phicol again 60 years later with Isaac. Isaac's going to be down in the land of the Philistines and talking with Phicol and Abimelech when we get to chapter 25 and 26. So the king, if you remember back in chapter 20, verse 15, where we saw Abraham's incident with Abimelech. Abimelech, after everything was said and done, promised or provided that Abraham, you know, provided Abraham with open access to live anywhere in his territory. He said, you know, wherever you want to live, you can go ahead and live. And so that probably created the tension. He's probably maybe hoping in a way that Abraham would go back out of his territory. But Abraham stayed. And that probably created the tension that now they got to deal with. They have to deal with. And it's going to do that through a preemptive treaty. And again, Abimelech recognizes very clearly that God is with him. Again, from the dream experience. The divine presence is with Abraham. So verse 23, you know, he wants him to swear. And that idea, swear, means to take an oath or make a vow. It's a solemn event. And not to deal falsely, don't deceive or lie. And again, he's a he's fearful of Abraham's potential impact on his future dynasty and his kingdom. You know, instead of dealing with me deceptively like you did before, now deal with me and my people with the word there in 23, loving kindness. And that is the Hebrew word hased. I think NASB translates it kindness, but kind of like the loving kindness carries more the idea. It's a heartfelt consideration is the picture here. Don't deal with me the way you almost dealt with me. Deal with me in the way I dealt with you. I told you you could stay anywhere. You know, deal with me in a very kind and generous way. Okay, verse 24. And Abraham said, I swear it. So Abraham agrees to Abimelech's proposal. I swear it is also translated, I will swear, depending on which translation you use. So the idea here is that he's committed to take this kind of an oath. And whether it's I swear it or I will swear, one's a little more future tense. Both of them are allowed in Hebrew language. It could be translated either way. I will swear, like LSB and NASB have it, emphasizes the immediate agreement in the conversation that's going on. There's an immediate agreement and a covenant to follow. Whereas I will swear emphasizes the intention and the action of the covenant. So Abraham swears, but they're going to go through a covenant ceremony. So either one's fine. Some commentators made a big deal about it. Either's allowable. Either one fits the context. I swear it, or I will swear. Okay, verse 25. But Abraham reproved Abimelech about the well of water, which the servants of Abimelech had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor did I hear of it until today. So reproved is also translated complained in NASB. It's translated rebuked. He lodged a complaint. Abraham had a, like my grandma put it, you know, my grandpa. Abraham had a bone to pick with Abimelech. And it's really contention over control of a water source. And water would have been very valuable in that area. So we're going to see the same issue of contention with Isaac and Abimelech when we get to Genesis chapter 26. But again, the valuable water supplies. You know, whose well is this? And so a well that was dug by Abraham. Verse 30, we'll see that this well was dug by Abraham's people and was being used by Abraham's household was seized. And the insinuation there, it was unlawfully seized. It was my well. We dug it. You told me I could go anywhere in this territory, and your people came, and they took this well from me, is the accusation. So Abimelech says, I had no idea. You know, I'm unaware of what happened. This wasn't with my approval. You know, I'm innocent. Just like with Sarah, you know, Abram's wife. He had no idea that Sarah was Abraham's wife. So here he's innocent too. I had no idea that anybody had done this. And he kind of shifts the blame to Abraham. You haven't said anything about it yet either. Why didn't you send somebody to talk to me? And the implication here is clearly that Abimelech will rectify that situation. So verse 27. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them cut a covenant. So Abraham initiates the covenant ritual, and again, we studied that kind of in depth back in chapter 15, where God cut a covenant with Abraham. But cut a covenant, or NASB has made a covenant. Again, that word made is literally cut. So I like the translation, cut a covenant. Some translations made a treaty. But again, the traditional covenant ratification ritual used across the ancient Near East in that day is where you take animals, you cut them in two, you make a passageway, and both parties to this agreement or treaty walk through the middle of that. And we talked before about how I like today's just have a signature, you know, you get maybe a notary to stamp it, but we're not chopping up animals and walking between them to make agreements. It's a very messy process. But one key thing that this pictures is this is your fate if you break this agreement. The slaughtered animals cut in two would be a very vivid picture of failure to keep your agreement. So again, both parties walk through the middle. Now back in chapter 15, if you remember, Abraham fell asleep and God walked through the middle of the chopped animals. And so that covenant was guaranteed by God alone. Here, both parties, and that would be the normal process, both parties would walk through this passageway created by these halved animals. And again, like the slaughtered animals, the parties would be destroyed if they broke their covenant. So, and the covenant basically consisted of an agreement to coexist peacefully in the area. Okay, peaceful coexistence. So verse 28. Then Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves, and Abimelech said to Abraham, "What do these 7 ewe lambs mean, which you have set by themselves?" He said, "You shall take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand, so that it may be a witness to me that I dug this well." So again, he kind of goes back. He kind of adds a rider, like how one commentator put it, kind of an addendum to the covenant. The general terms, we're going to live, coexist peacefully. But also, too, I want to make sure that you understand that's my well. Okay, that's my water. So this is just to confirm that part of the agreement. The lambs are a specific legal clarification. They're a witness. Like one translation called it legal proof. This is the legal proof that the well is mine. You know, I dug it, we've been using it, and it's mine. And again, that would be so essential. You know, like here in Nebraska, a well, I mean, we can dig thousands of wells, but there water was such a critical resource that he wanted to clarify that here. And the 7 reflects the importance of the well for Abraham's prosperity. You know, 7 ewe lambs would be quite a price to pay. But he was using that, again, as the legal proof that this well was indeed his, which was very important to his existence. Verse 31, "Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because there the two of them swore an oath." So that word Beersheba means well of oath. It can also mean well of 7. There's some debate, but well of oath fits very well here. So again, and Beersheba becomes a key location in Israel's history. It'd be about 15-20 miles southeast of Gerar, where Abraham had first met Abimelech. But a key location, we're going to see Abraham living there in chapter 22. We're going to see Isaac living there in chapter 26. We're going to see Jacob living there in chapter 28. And also, too, we read about Beersheba very regularly in the historical record. You know, you talk about the extent of Israel. It's from Dan to Beersheba, you know, Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, or sometimes it's Beersheba to Dan. In 1 Samuel chapter 3, 2 Samuel chapter 3 and 17 and 24, and 1 Kings 4, 1 Chronicles 21, 2 Chronicles 30. There's just a lot of references to Beersheba as this key site in the promised land. Verse 32, "So they cut a covenant at Beersheba, and Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, arose and returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called upon the name of Yahweh, the everlasting God. And Abraham journeyed in the land of the Philistines, sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days." So at some point, Abraham had moved. He'd gone to Gerar. But at some point, he had moved down to Beersheba, to the area of Beersheba, which would be about a 15 or 20 mile distance. So it's not too far to the southeast. It gets further if you have to walk it than if you drive it. But so he was in that area, and probably on the margins of the Philistine influence. So the land of the Philistines, there's 300 references. I didn't count them all up at once. It's listed. But 300 references to the Philistines in the Old Testament. And in Genesis chapter 10, verse 14, in the Table of Nations, we saw that the Philistines descended from Ham, the son of Noah. And the Philistines that we have in the patriarchal period here are the predecessors of the Philistines that we see in the future, who are some of the worst enemies of Israel. But at this point, that wasn't the case. Okay, they seem to be, as we're going through the patriarchal period, we'll run into the Philistines again, appear to be just peaceful tradesmen. And again, King Abimelech would have been a leader there. And then verse 33, he plants a memorial tree, and a drought-tolerant tamarisk tree would be endemic to that area. It was a natural tree, would last for a long time, you know, a lasting memorial to what had occurred at this site, this covenant signed, and place where Abraham then worshiped the Lord. So a witness to God's faithfulness, and particularly provision of water and peace would be the key things here. And verse 34, Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. We do have a new name for God or title for God introduced in verse 33, and El Olam, and it means the everlasting God, the eternal God. And I was going to go through, I might do that next week, but just the names that we've been, the names of God or titles for God that we've been introduced to so far in the book of Genesis, and that would be Elohim, Yahweh, El Elyon, Adonai, El Ra'ah, El Shaddai, and now El Olam. So we'll look at maybe that a little bit closer next week in the introduction. So, and then again, he stayed there, sojourned there for many days. And that word sojourn carries the idea of a temporary residence, not a permanent settlement. So he's hanging out in tents. And in Hebrews chapter 11, 9, we've been there before. You know, Abraham stayed in the promised land throughout all his years. He stayed there, you know, he dwelled in tents as in a foreign land. He doesn't ever have the inherited land promise himself. It's his posterity that has that. So we'll go ahead and close there with the prayer. So, dear Father, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for this day and so much for this time in your word. We just thank you again, Father, for the faithfulness of the man Abraham and how you used him to mediate your relationship with us, to establish the relationship of salvation by grace alone, through faith alone. And now we have the added revelation of knowing it's in Christ alone for our salvation. We just thank you, Father, that you've seen fit in your love to extend your hand of love to us and to save us despite what we deserve. You've saved us, and we just thank you and praise you for that. It's almost undescribable what you've done for us. Then we just ask you, Father, to bless us as we leave this room. Bless us as we hear the sermon to follow. Father, work in our hearts to cause us to be obedient to you in everything we do. In Jesus' name, amen.